you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. What you're about to hear is the conclusion of Con of England by Devin Field. If you haven't heard the first part, I'd recommend you go back and listen to that first, so you're not jumping into the middle of a story. Before we launch into today's show, a huge thank you to our latest patrons, Jason Heflin, Joanne Reynald, Joseph Conkel, Kyle Stockman, Heather Hart, Julia Jaffa, Michael Beach, Matthew McNally, Antonio Rodriguez, Gavin Wright, Fetty Dust, and My Glass is Dirty. I can't thank you enough. It's because of your support through Patreon that we're able to give you shows like the one you're about to hear today. If you haven't signed up yet, there are over 50 shows only available through Patreon, and you can sign up at patreon.com or go through the website at twilighthistories.com and follow the link. And now for today's show, Con of England, Part 2, by Devin Field.
There is a body by the water, and the body has begun to dance. With the peck and pull of birds, it casts its head this way, then that. With the ocean rolling up around it, makes hesitant motions, first in one direction, then the other. There is a movement in the neck, likely only a crab. Another wave pushes in, and an arm seems to swim across its surface in a gesture of what, exactly? It suggests you survey the shore before it, note its ordinariness. Why here? It seems to ask. Come here, it insists. You have been watching the body incuriously for some time now, caring neither for moisture nor fleas exploring your legs, your back to the grassy ledge, your seat upon the wet sand. But now you shift, stand and stretch, relieved somehow to feel your limbs ache, your back and neck ache. That, at least, is natural. A step, and an accompanying pull of pain from your leg. It's so pleasantly reassuring that you feel the momentary urge to scoop up the seashells in their handfuls and rake their broken edges across your face. To feel your skin's promise that it is indeed yours. But you don't, and your legs loosen as you walk. Something of a disappointment. At your approach, the body shies away, tugged by a wave. The gulls are less timid. One calls out in apparent anger, peering up at you with disbelief. Who are you to disturb this majestic feast? The head bobs on the water, its empty sockets turning to ask the same question. You do not recognize its face. There is some relief in the discovery, but also disappointment. So many gone. And where to? The second time had been worse. It would have been nice to find someone familiar here. Someone from among the missing. You take in the clothing such as it still is. Ignore the gull's petulant outrage at your rudeness. He was from here, maybe. Unless he had taken to local dress, which admittedly some did. The things they had brought with them having passed beyond the point of repair. Boots missing. Not that this tells you much. You're on the point of turning away when the water comes in again, fully lifting the body for a moment, shifting it about in its clothes. There, something at the base of the neck. How had this not been taken? You reach down. There's a stabbing beak at your wrist, but you ignore it as you untangle necklace from hair and brush away the grime. The piece on the chain is finely worked, if you're any judge, but its golden strands won't come into focus as something familiar. You do know the design, though. You're sure of it. Or you think you are. You stand, looking down, a fragment of poetry caught in your throat. Something about a startled sand grouse or a hawk. But it stubbornly refuses to be coughed up. You're still holding the necklace there in your palm, staring dumbly down, water licking around your ankles. And then you realize what you're hearing. Only the waves. Only the sea winds in among the oaks. Only the rustling of the grass. Not the birds. You look up. They're gone. Something had startled them, and it clearly wasn't you. Your head swivels. There, down the beach, riders. Hard to tell from here who they are, but then there's nobody you particularly care to see right now. You jog across the sand. A voice calls out, still distant, but you're up the bank now and into the woods. Branches clawing out at you, and your heart kicking up a little in fear. The feeling is not unwelcome. You let your mind wander, as your body does likewise. Well past the wood line now, and safely lost. Feet plunging blindly through mossy undergrowth and into the muddy depths below. You're pretty sure the camp is up ahead somewhere. Think you catch the wood smoke on the air, but you're not in any great rush to find out. It's good to be alone with yourself for a while, to try and take stock. That's why you'd gone down by the water. Not that that had done you much good. You'd wanted to take stock, but you'd only stumbled about foolishly, lost in your own mind, like a drunken merchant, certain he had left something somewhere. But where was it? What was it? You try again now to focus your thoughts. They seem slippery, ungraspable. You want to weep in frustration. What is wrong with you? Half-formed thoughts spill up to your lips, and you give them free rein. Fortunately, you see the sentries before they see you, and by the time you reach them, you've managed to compose yourself. You nod to the disinterested men. Do they even see you? And make your way into the camp. You're not the only one out of sorts. Those men on watch, huddled together as if against some great cold, would usually have been thrashed to alertness immediately. Perhaps you ought to have done it yourself, but there is a listless feeling in you, a listless feeling in the entire Mongol camp. There has been ever since the week before, since the crossing. As military operations went, you suppose it must be ranked a success. Just as arranged, and in no small part by you, the army had been transported over the sea in vast numbers, Batu Khan, Subutai, and many more by boat. So many boats. Boats beyond number, most would say. Though you are among those few who know the number. They had, with a few mishaps, reached the coast safely. The geomancers, by chance or by craft, having been largely correct about the weather. You had gone the way the rest had taken, the other way, the way in darkness and heat and confusion beneath the ground. And by that way, too, most had arrived as planned. But not all. Kadan, your friend, he had not been seen since. And you've no reason to believe, no matter your desire to think otherwise, that he'll ever be seen again. You ponder the looks on the faces of those sentries. Was it only men that had been lost? Was it only those missing, which, distressing as it was, had been expected? You feel as though something else has been changed by this crossing. Something has been taken. But what? Putting these thoughts aside, you try to empty your mind entirely as you walk to your tent. It is early in the day still, but you are already exhausted. By the time the messenger announces himself at your door, you've slightly recovered, having managed a bit of rest before midday prayer. You call for him to enter. He does so and speaks. Subutai is coming. He'll be here tomorrow. You nod. The messenger continues. He wanted you to know. The man is seemingly unwilling to leave your tent. What does he want? He speaks again. He'll be here tomorrow. Was there something else? You finally ask him. There's a long pause. No. He ducks back out of the tent and is gone. If you cared to think on it, you might find his behavior troubling. The news of Subutai's imminent arrival has clearly reached beyond your tent. A new energy stirs through the camp as you step outside, a new sense of bustle. You're glad the men have something to busy themselves with, other than to wait and dwell on what they had experienced. To dwell on those who are, incomprehensibly, no longer here. You let it pass around you, the crowds rushing about with every appearance of purpose. Entering their currents, you allow yourself to be carried along, glad not to direct your own feet. 2 carts loaded with arrows, 10 men with bags of grain, a pair of women laughing from one tent to the next. You are with all of them and more, if not one of them. In time, the crowd loses its power over you, and it's with some regret that you turn to the tasks at hand. You gather yourself and see to your responsibilities, making sure all is ready for the general's arrival. Perhaps, you allow yourself to think, perhaps with Subutai's coming, matters will return to normal. Perhaps by tomorrow, this fog will have passed. The night does not depart quickly. It tarries on in your tent, as if enjoying itself there all too much and unwilling to move on. Several times, you feel yourself falling towards sleep, only to come sharply awake, gasping for air, and pushing weakly at the blanket it has wrapped too tightly against you. In time, it ceases to toy with you, and you are allowed to find rest, of a kind. You find yourself seated at a great feast. The table it is set upon is simple enough, but the platters are piled high with food. There is a dish of meat with almonds and apricots to your left, a large bowl of something you don't recognize on your right. A glass is placed before you, and you drink, tasting pear and something else. Someone behind you speaks, someone away from the table. You know the voice, but cannot say where from, cannot turn to see them. Across from you, a face twists with laughter. You realize that you know it too. But where from? The hair is strange to you, the clothing also, but the face, you do know it. And below the face, what is that? As your vision swirls before you, you will your focus upon it. Is it? Yes, it is. The design you'd seen this morning, on the neck of the dead man. But then the table is gone. Before you now is a raven. Hooves thunder past, horse unseen. You cast around to find it, seeing only darkness and sands. When you look back, the raven has been replaced by a man. He speaks. I planted my cold arrow in Jiraiya, forcing the Hujaim to swarm around him like worshippers rushing round an idol. As the spears flew fast, he'd advance then retreat, like a hedgehog cowering and shrinking. Who cares if he lives? If he dies, better still. Many a warrior knows what it's like to be a grave for my arrows. When enemy lances fly taut his ropes, gouging the edges of trough and of well. He falls dead. The poem, its words somehow familiar to you, finished. You move towards his body where it lies. He wears the clothes of a Mongol lord. There is little time the next day to give the night much thought. You spend the morning first with your scouts, then soldiers, merchants, prisoners, people familiar with the region who have one way or another found their way into the Mongol camp. You're making sure that the options are ready for Subutai, that there are grasslands and waterways for groups of men and horses in numbers to move their great bodies east, their bulk disturbing the land as they go, that they not go hungry as they do so. So many stomachs to fill. There are reports that much of the stocks are spoiled, being spoiled maybe, and there is talk of sabotage. No concern of yours if it was, or to track down those responsible, only to see that it is replaced. Hunters have already gone out, and carts to the nearest towns and cities. You have not bothered to learn their names, and you wonder for a moment at your own lack of curiosity. You shake your head, just so long as it is seen to. The sun has nearly set by the time Subutai's messenger arrives with word that the general's camp has been assembled in a nearby field, and that you are expected. Of course, you go immediately. You go on foot through the wood between camps, the hubbub of one fading behind you, even as the other begins to rise ahead. There is just enough of dusk's light creeping down past the tree's thick growth for you to see, just so long as you don't wish to see very much. Around you, torches flit between trunks, as other men also carry orders or answer summons. You follow one of the torches as it dances on ahead of you, hear fragments of voice from beneath others. Not enough that you are not alone, but enough to startle any wild animals at the scale of the intrusion. There are hardly likely to be any of those still about, though. You doubt even the smallest bird or rodent would have survived the hunters, the great circle closing in like the coils of a snake, squeezing until nothing remained to be squeezed. How long, you wonder, would these woods remain quiet once the army had passed? The Mongols are creators of a great quiet. Ahead of you, the torch breaks through the tree line, its bearer appearing beside it on the grass, and in a moment, you too make your way out onto the field and into the general's camp. Two commanders are exiting the tent as you approach, moving away from its guards and bursting into quietly agitated discussion. They have not noticed you yet, and you slow your step, listening. "How shall we proceed?" asks the one. "With great care," replies the other. "With great care and attention that we do not meet our ends beneath the hooves." "Are we simply to tell him?" asks the first. "Obviously not," the other answers, "or at least I certainly won't." "Then what? Maybe have a shaman tell him, or a geomancer." "No," the second man fairly spits. "Their magic isn't never for telling anything that he doesn't want to hear. And that's magic indeed of a kind, but they're not going to tell him to put aside his cups."
"Then what?"
But you don't get to hear the "then what." The second one glances up and notices you first, and they move away, heads held together in discussion. You think over what you'd heard. Drinking had ever been problematic in the ranks of Mongol royalty, at times even fatally so. So there was no shortage of men of the Genghisid line that the two might have been speaking of. But the way they had spoken, in tones of dread gone unstated, and their unwillingness to be heard doing so, it was clearly not some minor royal cousin who intimidated these leaders of men. Someone more powerful than, maybe the Western Khan, Batu himself. The question lingers in your head as you enter and take your turn to see Subutai. The old general is no older for his passage across the sea and the rigors of travel. Indeed, he looks rather better than you feel, your eyes blinking against the smoke and caught immediately by his.
"Ah, Ahmed, you are still with us then."
It is as much an acknowledgement of your strange crossing as you're likely to receive. Subutai waves you forward. No one else is in the tent.
"I see all is ready here. Good. And I've seen your analysis of the lands east. Also good. We leave tomorrow. You'll be with us. We'll meet with Batu Khan. You'll be with him. He issues these commands with practiced ease, and then pauses, as if uncertain? No, as if to be certain that you listen. He leans almost imperceptibly forward, and you realize that you have unthinkingly craned in towards him, close enough to taste the irag on the air between you. He speaks again. All is not well. Kublai comes west, and Batu goes to meet him. Khans are like arrows. They say that bundled together, they are harder to break. But I say that they only fly true alone. You do not send two through the air at once from the same bow. There is a pause. His eyes dig deeper into yours, seeming to will you now to understand him in full. This thing we do, to join Khan and Khan, it is wrong. The words on the rider's lips tell us there is to be peace. They tell us the great Khan's brother comes west to do honor to his illustrious relation. But were that true, he would send gifts. There would be precious stones and exotic animals bound this way. Not men and horses. Not a Khan. You do not answer. Do not move. Barely breathe. Does he have more to say? He does. There is great danger for us in this moment. And I do not mean the remnants of Al-Andalus. I do not mean the Pope and his kingslings concealing themselves in Cairo, as if we will not find them there also. And I do not mean their Mamluk host, for he too will fall. Only time stands between the Sultan and death or servitude. The danger, as it's always been, is within us. No power has ever been so great as ours, but like those that came before, we risk tearing ourselves apart and leaving the bones of our great empire bleaching in the sun for those who come after to contemplate. You allow yourself to blink. Subutai sighs. I do not know why I tell you all of this. Perhaps because you need to know. But what you really need to know is this. It should be 3 days from now that we meet with Batu. When we do so, be watchful. When we draw closer to Kublai, be wary. When the two Khans come together, observe everything. You have a good mind for details, I believe. And though Batu is surrounded by bodyguards, there are things such men are prone to miss, that they must miss. You, though you will not be so close to him, will not. You find your voice and ask the question. How far away is Kublai? How long until we reach him? Subutai answers. Not far and not long. I've had word that he was preparing to cross the Rhine. By now, he will have already done so. The days that follow your meeting with Subutai go quickly and smoothly. The arrival of the soldiers that had come by sea seems to have allowed those who had taken the other path to pretend that nothing unusual had happened, to forget as they go about the business of the camp at night and the numbingly long rides of the day. You pass villages that seem deserted, piles of food left as offerings outside their limits, the only confirmation that indeed they still hold life. You pass some that decidedly do not. The bones clad in rotting cloth, the only indication that they ever did. Fields are eaten bare and trampled beyond recognition. Woods cleared, streams near to drank dry. In their thousands, the mounted army thunders back through lands conquered not so many months before. On the third day, just as Subutai had estimated, the force joins with that of Batu. The army now sprawling over more fields, the hunt going forth to cast a wider net, the towns being squeezed a little tighter for supplies, their people struck a little harder to ensure they are really giving over all they can. You go that night to the Khan's camp, not because you have business there, but because the general's words remain searingly fresh in your mind. You are to watch. So you do.
You walk the perimeter first, noting the alertness of the guard, identifying yourself to them when challenged. And then, having peeled the fruit, you cut inward, catching flickers of conversation in the army's many tongues as you do. It all seems innocent enough. Angry voices over a dice game disagreement. Singing shouted down by those near it. Reminiscing round a fire. Yet after that conversation with Subutai, every exchange seems weighted with hidden meanings that you can only guess at. Are you missing something? You shake your head and move on. Past three women of the Khan's household, cloaked in a cloud of excited whispers. Past young men, boys really, joking rudely to one another as they see to the horses. Past a solitary soldier, his unsteady bulk wreathed in liquor as he urinates. And next to the Khan's own tent, too. You quietly tut to yourself and approach it, hearing the festivities within. The clatter and clamor of raised voices and cups. And you listen out for Batu Khan's own distinctive tones. And then you hear them behind you. It's the drunk, swaying heavily past and singing quietly to himself. And in the light of the torches, you recognize Batu Khan. Face bloated and red. Eyes glassy and unfocused. Hand as he reaches for the tent post, shaking. You stand frozen as he enters and shouts a greeting that is matched by those within. You exhale heavily. It disturbs you to see the Khan in such appalling shape, so unhealthy. Makes sense now that Subutai would also have been concerned. That he would have been concerned enough to reveal his worries to the two men you'd overheard. Just as he'd done to you. You see now that he is right to be worried. You see little of your Khan the next day. You hear that he has insisted on going hunting. And hunting is hard to come by in close proximity to such a large mounted force, especially one that has been eating off the land. The army proceeds only very slowly east, setting camp early and waiting on its leader, whose party arrives after dark. Again, you find reason to drift into his camp, and again hear the festivities inside his tent. Whatever is being done to slow his drinking, it doesn't seem to be working. You turn back, seeing nothing unusual on the way. What is it anyways that you should be looking for? Not the Khan's failing health? Not the things which his bodyguard will notice. Then what? You ponder the questions in your own quiet tent, a blank page once more sitting before you, and defying your efforts to write something, anything. As you place it to the side and settle instead for sleep, it occurs to you that you've written nothing at all. Nothing since the crossing. Those questions are still with you when you wake up. Word in the camp has it that a sizable Hungarian contingent has deserted unnoticed in the night and ridden south. It is not so very alarming in itself. Not all of the Mongols' allies appreciate their new lot in life, and men have already been sent in pursuit. But for them to go now, just as the army draws close to Kublai, it feels like weakness. And you're certain that Kublai will hear of it and see things much the same. Still, there is little to be done now for the rest of you, but to continue east. By late morning, a river of horsemen has carried you alongside a thick wood. You idle beneath its branches for a time, chewing on dried meat and watching people, animals, and supplies flow past. Large wagons of food and weapons, and even larger flat carts carrying the great tents of the leadership. Your eyes follow the river back toward its origins, back beyond their reach in the direction of the camp. The skies that way are dark, bad weather on its way, and likely to catch you. By the time you make camp that evening, it has done so. meadow quickly becoming mire as tents are set against the rain. You manage to make your now nightly walk around the Khan's personal celebration, the downpour not quite overwhelming the sounds of merriment within. You don't linger long, though. It's not a night for that. You're eager to get into the shelter of your own tent and to find something warm and dry to wrap yourself with, but it seems you will have to wait. A messenger, Subutai. You're near to drowning in your clothes by the time you reach him. Taking your place among the small group gathered in his tent, you stand, feeling the water drip from your hair and run down your spine. You stand, feeling it pool beneath you, and you listen. Subutai speaks. The site set for the meeting with Kublai Khan is very close. Most of the army will remain nearby. They'll wait a half day's ride from here. Others will continue with Batu Khan. You here will be with those others. You all know what to do. Subutai nods, turns aside to the man next to him. He is finished. Looking around, you think about those last words. You see the two commanders from the other night. Remember your own meeting in this tent. But what about these other men and women? What have they been told to do? The bad weather continues through the night and into the next day. You wonder how the skies could ever have held so much rain, so much thunder, reaching you now in distant bellows. Camp is broken in a kind of silence, with whatever words that are spoken immediately being swallowed up by the elements. By early afternoon, you leave much of the men at the chosen site, in open grasslands alongside a stream. Not that finding water feels like the most pressing concern, what with all that still falls from above. It's a much smaller force that's with you now, and not with far to go, just over a low hill to where the stream comes to meet a lake, and where Kublai Khan will meet Batu. The feeling around you, it's one of excitement. It's no minor event that you ride towards, and Batu himself is with you, shouting out to men around him in good humor, his voice carrying up to you even with the wind and the rain and the hoofbeats. His mood is contagious, the men around you clearly uplifted by their proximity to the Khan of the West. But there is nervousness too, or is that only your own? How many of these men have spoken to Subutai in his tent? And where is the general? You'd assumed he'd be here, but you don't see him yet. You exhale heavily, tip your face up to let the rain strike upon it, and then you follow the rider ahead of you, over the crest, and down towards the lake's edge, where an advance party has already assembled the beginnings of a camp. With the others, you join them, you see to your responsibilities, and you wait. You wait all through the next day, keeping yourself dry as best you can, keeping an eye on matters in the camp, or on the inner wall of your tent, where you find yourself sitting, staring blankly, no thought even of attempting to write. The sun is going down. You walk over to the nearby wood and pass your time there for a bit, letting the bushes be your guides in sending you right or left around them and further into the woods. The smell of the trees is strong, and your fingers stray across the rough bark, until before one of them, you pause. The tree is magnificent, a gnarled little tower, an outpost against its more powerful neighbors. You step back to admire it, up to the crown of its leaves, and down to its roots. And what's that you see? There, in the little pool of water, collected at its base. You lean down, but it's only your own muddled reflection. For a moment, silly as you now feel, you were sure you'd seen that shape again, the design that the dead man on the beach had hanging round his neck. Why are you even still thinking about that? What's wrong with you? What is happening? You have the terrible feeling that you know the answers to these questions, that they're there within you, but you cannot find them, that dig away as you might, you cannot reach them. Your head begins to ache. Following the sound of voices, you return to the camp. The morning finds you a poor fit for your surroundings. Some of Kublai's men had arrived in the night, and now, everywhere you look, there are great displays of camaraderie. They greet each other with all the exuberant enthusiasm of long-distance family that will, when once again parted, complain of the other's foul habits and ways. You chuckle slightly, watching Batu's people play host in this place, so many days' ride and distance from their berths. There is the sharing of food and drink and song. There are stories and boasts exchanged, along with news, from military conquests to the doings of family afar, tales of debts and births and deaths, whispers of a widespread disease that few survived. You watch it all, close to it, sometimes surrounded by it, never part of it. You are, in the end, not quite one of them. Maybe that was why Subutai had asked you to be here. But where is the old general? You still haven't seen him since that night in his tent. And no sign of Batu today yet either. Perhaps he is waiting for Kublai's arrival. If so, he does not have long to wait. Looking up, you see more horses approaching. People, carts, other animals. Kublai has arrived. The newcomers stream into the camp, some immediately leaping to work, others throwing themselves from their mounts to rest on the ground or to greet those who'd come before them. And Kublai, that must be him there. In his face, his body and bearing, he is not so very unlike his cousin Batu, but it's his clothes that set him apart. Kublai is dressed in rich silks of gold, the cloth strewn with gems as if they were stars in the sky, and wrapped in a finely worked belt of leather, gold, and still more precious stones. Next to him, you think, Batu would look quite plain. And where is Batu? Kublai! The friendly shout beside you takes you off guard, as does your Khan striding past to greet Kublai. The two embrace. I bring greetings, booms Kublai, from the great Khan, Monka. Batu grins wide and replies, I bring greetings from the great Khan, Batu. There is laughter, but do Kublai's eyes narrow in response? His smile seems friendly enough. Men swirl about the two, pressing in on where they stand, pushing you back. Kublai leans in, speaking quietly now. You try to lean in too, to hear it, but strain as you might, you only catch Batu's reply as he claps Kublai on the back. Tomorrow, tomorrow. You're still trying to swim closer through the crowd, but in the noisy acclaim for the two Khans, it is useless. The man next to you is shouting something, so loud, yet you barely make out what it is. A stray elbow catches you above the ear. Reeling, for a moment unsure of your feet, you draw back, others willingly taking up your place, and you stumble away. All day long, there are celebrations. There is meat prepared in great quantities, and pear cooked with cardamom and cloves. There is liquor, so much liquor, wines of grape and rice and palm, along with ale and fermented mare's milk. You quickly lose track of how many cups are thrust into your hands by men eager for you to drink, but not sufficiently patient to wait and see if you will. In any case, they have other things to distract them. Kublai's people bring forth a cart, more a tree mounted on wheels, really, worked all in silver and complete with serpents that wrap their tails around its upper branches and snake down to open wide their jaws. At the peak of the tree is a figure, also silver, with a horn to his lips. And when drink is called for, by some mechanism you cannot detect, the horn sounds. Then, much to the delight of the onlookers, liquor flows from the serpent's mouths, to be caught in drinking vessels below. It is truly a wonder to behold, and it is not the only one. From another cart, strange metal men are unloaded, musicians each with their own different drum. They are set upon a platform and pushed out into the lake, and soon after, they begin to play, entirely of their own accord, and with nobody touching them. You have heard of such devices before, but never seen them in person. And later on, as it gets darker, there are dazzling explosions in the sky, eruptions of light and sound, and liquor, always more liquor, shouting and song. Lightheaded, you walk through the middle of a wrestling match, ignore the cries of annoyance, and seek solace, peace, among the trees. The darkness and the distance from camp come as a relief. You wander a while, and then sit, your back against a fallen log, your eyes shut, mind trying to find some place of calm. You touch the side of your head, wincing at the lump there beneath your fingers. Here, at least, it is peaceful. Perhaps you'll even sleep. There's little hope of much rest in your tent tonight, or at least not for a while, until they have drunk themselves into slumber. May as well settle in to wait. You have just managed to bend your body into a comfortable position when you hear the noise. A horse, neighing quietly behind you. Your eyes snap open in a jolt of realization. Behind you, not in the direction of the camp. You get to your feet, swaying in the night air a moment, listening. There it is again, definitely a horse. You make your way toward the sound, walking softly, though not yet entirely sure why. At the edge of the wood, you find them. Horses, not just one, and carts, though no sign of anybody with them. What are they doing here? You step tentatively out of the trees. Still, no one. You creep over to the nearest cart. Weapons, it's full of weapons. You freeze, and a man steps next to you. Before you can react, he has leapt up into the cart, taken up a cloth-wrapped bundle, and passed it down to you. "Quickly now," he hisses. He must have mistaken you for someone else. You take it, mutely, feeling the shifting weight of swords sliding against one another within, and then strike off into the dark. You pass another cart, then come alongside another. There are voices murmuring up ahead. Quietly, but quickly, you place the heavy bundle next to a wheel, and then you scurry, doubled over, for the cover of the trees. Your body is tense despite the darkness, but there are no arrows, no shouts of alarm. You must warn Batu about the carts and the weapons. You must hurry, but it's hard. The forest, which had been so soothing, is now completely unforgiving. Every root reaching up to trip you, every branch to swipe at your face. Every tree trunk, a sentry, standing ready to cut you down, as you careen through their inky depths. You must warn Batu, but out of the trees it's no easier. So many people, their grinning, sweaty faces, now like horrifying masks. What did they hide? It's not far to Batu's tent. Even accounting for time spent shoving aside offered cups, you reach it quickly, coming down a quiet row between tents and approaching it from the side. Not so many people here, but why are there no guards out front? You halt, hesitant, listening. Nothing. No sounds of celebration inside. For the special occasion, he must have gone elsewhere to drink. Not Kublai's tent, though. This is Batu's territory. Somewhere else? You're on the point of leaving to look for him elsewhere, when someone slips out the entrance and without looking round, turns away from you with quick steps. It isn't Batu, you can tell that much. You decide to look inside, maybe the Khan is there. He is. Batu is sprawled out on his back, his eyes are open, and he is very still. You stand there for a moment, equally transfixed, seeing his face frozen in a look of gentle questioning, his arm flung outward, still loosely clutching the goblet that has spilled its contents across the carpet. Mare's milk, still wet. He is dead. Still wet. Who had just left the tent? You spin about and seize up a sword by the entrance on your way out. One of the Khan's own. He would be furious. You look down along the row of tents. There. There they are. You break into a run, the sword naked in your hand, a shout at your lips. No. Can't alert them. Closer. A group of five men stumbles across your path, arms round each other's shoulders. You bowl one of them aside, hear shouts of protest, and run on. There they are. They're moving behind a tent, briefly hidden. You take the corner at speed, sword ready, and briefly wondering why you feel so compelled to give chase. Why you're carrying a sword. You're neither soldier nor guard, yet your body hurls itself forward as if pulled on a rope. They're still ahead, again turning. It's so loud with yelling, and now with a terrible rising hum. You must be imagining it, but it's so very loud. Again, a corner. There are running figures around you now. You wonder if it's you they're chasing, or your quarry. You want to shout, to call down the whole camp, upon this person who may have murdered the Khan. But the humming is too loud. You don't think you could be heard over it. Another corner. You've almost caught them. They're not so fast as you. Another corner. You see a shape lurking in the shadows of the tent, hacked down, sinking your sword into something. Wrench it free, strike again, and again. You look up. Shapes rushing at you in the firelight. Except one, turning away, walking away. The humming is too loud now. It obliterates all else. Hello? Good, you've woken up. You know, we weren't sure if you would. The speaker is a man in some kind of white tunic. You know him? No, you can't. You don't even recognize his clothes. They're so strange. He is speaking again. What happened? No, don't answer that. I know you can't. We tried to help you, you know. Tried to contact you, to reach you with messages, to nudge you in the right direction. But something in the timeline. And then we are trying to bring you back. We should never have sent you. We won't be sending anyone else until the irregularities can be properly understood. And who knows when that will be. He pauses, looking down at you, but you're too distracted by your surroundings to respond. What is this place? You're lying on a bed, machines you do not recognize on either side, shiny metal surfaces everywhere you look. You look back to the man standing over you. There is something. That's it. There is a design sewn into his tunic. You know it from somewhere. He nods to someone out of your field of vision. Read it. Maybe it'll trigger something in his memories. Another voice. A poem. Time, not war, has made me weak. A hero, I advance on that coward death. My tribe, summoned to fight, knows how I smile, commanding death, my hand wielding the Indian blade. In war, my clan are the finest riders, gripping the reins in hands that killed Lakit and Ibn Hujir, Hajib, and the sons of Aban. You recognize the words. You're sure of it. But where from? The man in front of you sighs. He looks down to you, and he speaks again. There is so much that you have lost. So much. Thank you.
What you just heard was the conclusion of Con of England by Devin Field. You can find more of Devin's work at his podcast, Human Circus, where he tells you stories of medieval life. We've been renovating the podcast and have pulled down some of the older shows. They can all be found in Patreon. Some will be re-released after some work to consolidate and remaster them. Others that don't follow the regular format will remain in Patreon. The main reason for doing this is so that when new listeners are testing us out, it won't matter where they land. Every episode will give them a high-quality example of what they can expect from other shows. As I say, there are currently over 50 shows in Patreon, which I built over the last decade. Many of these shows have been casualties of past renovations. Others are bonus shows that continue the story. And still others are from an experimental podcast I never launched. There's lots of great stuff to listen to, over 50 shows, as I say. And when you sign up, you help us grow the show. We're reinvesting the funds back into the podcast in order to hire amazing storytelling podcasters to produce shows like the one you heard today. So sign up at the website at twilighthistories.com and click through to Patreon, or go directly to patreon.com and run a search for the Twilight Histories. See you on the inside. I'm Jordan Harbour. Until next time, take care.